The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. 20 years ago, I did my third interview with a writer named Joseph Cannon. He had just published a novel called The Good German, and he regularly came through Dayton on book tours back in those days. I'd interviewed him for his first book, his second book, this book, his third one, and he came through one more time for a fourth book, and that's it. I haven't talked to him since, so we did four interviews in about 5 or 6 years, and that was the end. I'd like to talk to him again. I know he's still active, but just hasn't happened. And he's really a pleasant man, very articulate. As I was listening to this digitized version of our original interview, I thought, what a well-spoken guest. And I also thought, now that we record all of our interviews in advance, what a difference it makes when you're doing a live interview and the person knows it's live. And they're more careful about the way they speak. And he has a beautiful voice. And it's really a great novel. Let's listen now to Joseph Cannon talking about The Good German on the Best of the Book Nook. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the program Joseph Cannon. His new novel is The Good German. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
Your first book, Los Alamos, I remember it well, and I remember your first visit to the program to talk about it. You have a real thing for this period, don't you?
Well, I didn't know that I did. You know, it started with Los Alamos, but I do keep coming back to it, and I guess for the same reason. I just think it's wonderfully dramatic, and everything that happens then is important. It's, to me, the sort of hinge of the century. Originally, because I was drawn to the story of the atomic bomb, I thought this is the true pivotal moment. The world is completely different afterwards. You can never go back. And I think the same thing is true of the Holocaust and knowledge of the Holocaust and what it tells us about ourselves or just being human. You can never revisit. It can never be 1944 again. It will forever after be after 45. And I think it's the beginning of our lives. You know, the way we have lived ever since was largely decided at this period, so it seems to me a really rich, fertile background period to do stories.
1945 to 1948, would you call that the cusp between World War II and the Cold War?
Yeah, and the Cold War starts virtually the first week of the Allied victory. You know, I mean, the Russians take Berlin in May 1945, and indeed VE Day is May 45. We enter Berlin July 5th, so the Russians have had it for 2 months before we get there. And almost immediately, the Cold War begins. It's a standoff, it's a face-off. A lot of it is just posturing, who gets to be on what road, etc. But the opening battle, it seems to me, was the race for the scientists. And people saying, no, we're going to have the rocket scientists, and the Russians saying, no, we're going to have them. It was Eisenhower who said, it's the only reparations we're likely to get. And we had a big program to try and round up as much technological information and indeed the people themselves as possible. And I think it was the opening shot. It was, you know, the real reason for doing so was to prepare for the next war, and the next war was clearly going to be against these people down the street who had just been allies a week beforehand.
The Good German, sort of an ironic title.
Well, deliberately so. You know, when I was growing up, I suppose the answer to that would have been there is no such thing. Or the only good, you know, is. But in fact, where the title comes from is that it's a phrase I kept encountering. I was interested in the American occupation. That's really what I wanted to write about because it seemed to me so little known. It was even little known by me, and I think that I'm a World War II buff, and I'm one of those people that keep the History Channel alive as long as they have those documentaries on. And I thought, but for me and for a lot of people, it stops in 45 and doesn't pick up again until the Berlin airlift in 48. You know, what happens in between? And it seemed to me that this was, with the exception of our adventure in the Philippines, the first and indeed the only time that America has been a true imperial power in the original sense of the word. We had life and death sovereignty over foreign subjugated people, 20 million of them in our zone, and we had it for years. And I thought, what was that like? What were we like, etc.? So I wanted to write about the occupation forces, a kind of American Raj. I thought it would make a great setting for the story. But in researching it and doing so, what became clear to me is that it was really going to be, the book was really going to be about Berlin and about the Germans as well as the Americans. The phrase that I picked up and used for the title would be the American military coming into any of the, not just Berlin, but, and because that was quadripartite power, but let's say a town in our zone. In Bavaria, we'd come in and say, well, we want a new town council here that we can run, and we don't want any Nazis. We just want the good Germans. And I thought, you know, after 12 years of totalitarian rule, it's beyond a naive statement. It's a really intriguing one. Who exactly would that be in 1945? Who was a good German? Who was making that decision? How do you judge that?
Well, I guess one certification was certification.
Certification. If you wanted to work for the Allied powers, and those were the only jobs that existed, you had to fill out a Fragebogen. This is a questionnaire. And essentially, you had to say that you had never done anything untoward. And there were various degrees of involvement. Either you were a hardcore Nazi, you were somebody who had just had to go along. I mean, a mailman, for instance, had to join the party just to keep his job.
Or a truck driver.
Or a truck driver, in many cases, particularly if they had worked for the government. But, of course, people lied. I mean, many, many people had been official party members. Many people had been believers, for that matter. And if you wanted to survive in this new post-war environment and eat, it was as fundamental as that, you had to be part of the new regime, so you denied the past and the old. The irony, of course, was that we had all the party records, and so we could double-check, and lying about party affiliation really didn't get you very far.
Those meticulous Germans.
Those meticulous Germans, but also those forgetful Germans, because the only reason we had it is that a pulp mill operator in Bavaria was supposed to, paper mill, was supposed to pulp all these cards, index cards and records. It was the entire Nazi Party membership. And they had kept these, as you say, meticulous records over the years. And as the Allies were approaching, they said, get rid of them, pulp them. And he somehow just didn't get around to it, or perhaps thought he had more time on his hands than he ended up having. And the Americans, luckily for us, got in there very quickly and discovered this immense treasure from our point of view.
My guest is Joseph Cannon. His new novel is The Good German. And this is his third novel, and it's no coincidence, his third visit to the Book Nook, and we're very glad to have you back. There was a lot of money to be made in 1945 in Berlin, wasn't there?
A lot of money, and all of it illegal. It, you know, the black market becomes a great leitmotif in the book, partly because I think it's a wonderful background to use if you're writing a thriller, a novel of any kind of intrigue, which this is. But it was also a fact of life, and somehow explained a great deal of what was going on. I wanted to get the sort of moral arc in Berlin. This might be on the most generous or least important side. You know, you finally get to horrifying crimes on the other end of the arc. But the black market itself, well, a statistic always, if it stops you on the page and is suggestive, is one that I tend to remember and want to throw at other people. In July of 1945, American servicemen in Germany were paid about $1 million in military pay, and they sent home postal orders worth $3 million. Obviously, huge fortunes were being made. And in some part, you have a triangle. On the one angle, there are the Germans who are starving. They're literally desperate. They're hungry. They will sell anything, family heirlooms, the china themselves often. And they need to eat. The official ration in July is 1,500 calories a day. That's if you have one of the top ration cards. In practice, it's closer to 1,100 or 1,200, and that's just a little more than people were getting in the camps. So these people are hungry. Some are downright starving. And if you have children, you're in a desperate situation. You'll do just about anything. At the other point in this triangle, you have the Russians. They have not been paid for 3 years. And now the Russian authorities have got their hands on duplicate sets of plates. We all agreed, all the allies, were going to use a new occupation currency, new marks. The expectation was that we would be reimbursed for these, but in fact what happened is that the Russians just took the printer and ran them off, and in fact paid off their troops 3 years' worth of salary, but said to them, but by the way, these can't be converted back into rubles, so if you want to spend, you have to do it here. So in this utterly destroyed city, we have often village peasant soldiers who had never even seen plumbing before with a lot of money in their pockets and nothing to spend on except anything, quite literally, that ticked. They liked anything that seemed to be an appliance. And famously and humorously to Americans, what became the great, great symbol of this period was the Mickey Mouse watch, which could go for as much as $1,000. And usually went for at least 500. So you can imagine an American serviceman would write his mother and say, send as many watches as you can get your hands on. There are fortunes to be made here in the streets. Because we, of course, could convert back to dollars. And then at the other end, the final end of this triangle, you have the well-stocked Americans who have these cornucopias of PXs. And they're rich in goods and stuff. Cigarettes, as an example, you know, you get a carton of cigarettes a week at the PX for 50 cents. It was a nickel a pack in those days. The street value of that carton was about $100. So with that kind of markup, you would have to either be a saint or a ferociously heavy smoker not to somehow participate in this ongoing market. And when you then add to that any kind of canned food, I mean, a can of tuna fish from home was worth a lot. People were hungry. Liquor, chocolate, any of those things. But cigarettes became the great dominant currency. This was the one thing that was exchanged, and values were attached to it. So this would be worth 10 cigarettes. This would be worth 3 cigarettes, etc.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, your source for public service journalism and music discovery. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's the best of the book. Now, going back 20 years to my third interview with Joseph Cannon, talking about his novel, The Good German. And I loved his statistic that he cited. After we went into Berlin, after World War II ended, and we had all these American soldiers in Berlin, they were mailing back money from their paychecks back home to the United States. And he cited that statistic that they were paid $1 million over a particular period, and they sent back $3 million. And I loved his explanation for where all that extra money was coming from. We'll continue with the Best of the Book Nook right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. We went back 20 years to talk about a novel called The Good German. My guest is Joseph Cannon. His new novel is The Good German. Set the scene.
The scene is we have our protagonist had been a CBS correspondent in Berlin during the great Bill Shirer days. He was one of Murrow's boys. This was a kind of romantic period in journalism. And he had been part of it. Berlin was fascinating to him because if you're a news person, the late 30s in Berlin was an exciting place to be. But even more importantly, he was in love with a German woman called Lena. And when he is thrown out at the outset of the war, she, of course, has to stay behind. It is now 1945. He's managed to get an assignment covering the Potsdam Conference. His real agenda is to come back and find her, and indeed find out what's happened to Berlin in general. What he finds is that it's totally devastated. she is obviously not going to be at home. You know, the people have scattered just like the bricks. It's a mess. He also discovers that at Potsdam there's not going to be any story because none of the 500 correspondents assigned to this are allowed to attend the conference. They're given some press handouts and whatever rumors they can pick up, and they just hang out in Berlin. Instead, as he's looking for her, what he stumbles upon is a murder. There is a murdered American with a great deal of money on him, which inevitably means that he was connected to the black market. And Jake, our hero, thinks, right, this is the way in. This is the way to get a story out of this place. I want to understand what's going on with the occupation, with Berlin itself, and what's happened here. And this becomes the plot device for us to start unpeeling the layers of what life in 1945 in Berlin was like, which I think is fundamentally what the book is.
You describe 1945 as a hinge year. We've got this situation going on in the former Third Reich. We have the atomic bombs dropping in Japan later that year. We have the discovery of the Holocaust.
Right.
2001 is kind of a hinge year now for us too, isn't it?
Yes, and it's one of these things, you recognize it as you're going through it. There was a line that I used in my previous book where a father says to his son, you know, the trouble with history is you have to live through it before you see how it's going to turn out. And I think we all have that sense at the moment of living through history. And in some part because we don't know how it's going to turn out. It seems to be a totally new field and a new sort of world that we're entering. That was undoubtedly the feeling that was going on in 45 as well. You know, these were decisions that had to be made almost on the spot, and a life and a government that had to be made up as we went along. There was no precedent for this. Everybody always fights the last war, and we were expecting the last peace. The Germans would give up. We would go in, we would chase out the bad guys, put the good Germans into power, and go home, which is what everybody profoundly wanted to do. Instead, there is this devastated country that's in ruins that is going to be a bulwark against our instant new enemy, so it behooves us, not only out of humanitarian reasons, because the people are starving, but also out of cynical political reasons, that we've got to get this country up and running. And they are going to be our new friends. And it's relatively easy to do because one of the things I kept encountering in the research that was interesting to me is that the American, particularly at the GI level, Germany is the first country they felt comfortable being in Europe. They hated France after the invasion. They just didn't like it. And they get to Germany, and what they see is a country not unlike home. There is this constant refrain that kept coming up in things that I would read, that they're just like us. They're just like us. And I thought that's a very provocative statement for 1945, given what's just happened, because at the same time that they see the results of the war, they also uncover what isn't the war, the thing that is this enormous crime. Huge. I mean, they're stunned by this, as I think we still are over 50 years later. It's the Holocaust is the worst thing that's ever happened in our culture, I guess. And how could they have done it is the other question that's always on their minds. And then how could they have done it? They're just like us. And the quick and easy answer that most people had was, well, they didn't do it. Somebody else did it. But there was nobody else there. So it becomes a real problem. I think the moral dilemma of how you deal with this sort of guilt assessment. I mean, here is a conquering army who is now being called upon to become judge and jury of the greatest crime we've ever known. And we're still quarreling about how these lines are drawn. Do you put a whole society on trial? Is it just a few people who did it? Is complicity and knowledge itself a guilt thing? It's a very, very thorny issue, and certainly thorny for them, and brand new. They didn't know how to deal with this.
Well, it was much more black and white, I think, in 1945. We actually had a federal government run by a madman who was officially in charge and had been for a dozen years, and everyone knew who he was, and everyone knew what kind of policies he had been enacting. We didn't know the full extent of what he had done until after the rubble and the dust cleared. But into this vacuum, just a brief vacuum, the Soviet troops come pouring, having endured horrible atrocities at the hands of the Nazis as a nation. And they came in, and the vacuum was filled, and they exerted their power and their rage. And then the other allies came in, and it was a battle for power. And a real footnote in the book is the horrible, horrible things that were done by the Soviet troops.
It had always been the greatest German fear, the Mongol in horde, you know, the invasion from the east. And maybe the only true thing Goebbels ever said, he would warn and exhort the population by saying, the peace will be worse. And it was. The Russians understandably saw Berlin as a prize, and understandably, I suppose, if you want to take that position, saw it as a place to exact revenge. And exact it they did. It was just something out of the ancient world, the kind of destruction that was going on in the city. There were 100,000 reported rapes. And you think, all right, let's stop on that figure for a minute. It means that the actual number must have been incalculable, because we all know that not everybody reports them. And who indeed were they being reported to? The Soviet authorities. And the only reason to report being raped is so you could qualify for the free and subsidized abortions that were being handed out by the Soviets to deal with this problem. The human cost of all of this is, you know, then you go off into infinity, this sort of thing. It was a horrifying time, and the result of this battle, this last-ditch battle, which was essentially against women and children, I mean, the men had deserted Berlin and left it wide open, is to create what is still referred to in Berlin today as zero hour. This is when everything bottoms out. There's no food, no medicine, no services, no police, nothing. There is only crime and marauding troops and just enormous fear. I don't think that, you know, there's a hierarchy of suffering. I think people that talk about didn't they get what they deserved? Well, you know, maybe we all get what we deserve in the end, but I don't think this is ever a way to look at it. What happened in Berlin was an exceptionally brutalizing experience for them to get through, and replaced almost instantly by them becoming the battleground between the former allies, who were going to use them as the test area. It's a city which, even today when you visit, and it's an exciting, new, dynamic city now, etc., but it still has this weight of history on it everywhere. It's a fascinatingly layered city in that way.
My guest is Joseph Cannon. We're talking about his new book, The Good German. I have always been intrigued by this period. My dad was a World War II veteran. He fought in the Pacific Theater, but I can remember reading histories about this and always hungering for more. And clearly, you're a big history buff.
Yeah, this is also, you know, this is the most dramatic thing that has ever happened. I mean, World War II is still an endlessly interesting period. And I don't mean just in terms of exploiting it for dramatic purposes. It just was the most significant event of the century. It was also, which sometimes gets forgotten, when we make new war movies, which inevitably look at the heroic aspects of it, and the heroic aspects were there. This happens in any kind of conflict, war situation. But what gets overlooked in this is that it was also the worst thing that ever happened. There was something like 60 million people who died in this war. You know, something on that scale, a war of that proportion, is something that does not easily go away. Somebody said to me at one point, well, you write historical thrillers. And I said, well, you're very young. I think of it as the recent past. You know, it's not so historical. I think we are the children of the father generation that fought in the war. I grew up certainly in its shadow, where you would know people who had been killed in it. It was a palpable thing. People spoke of it and would always speak of it.
And your reporter, who is your protagonist, he has certain watershed experiences that I think are very descriptive to the reader, and I'm sure to the author, of the horror. The description of shaking hands with the fellow who just got out of the camp, and he said he's shaking hands with a skeleton, and he just didn't know what to do.
He has gone down there as a reporter. This is at Nordhausen, which was a slave labor camp, fed into by Auschwitz and some of the other camps, and Buchenwald. And because reporters were required to wear uniforms, the concentration camp victim assumes that he is a liberating soldier, not a reporter, and clasps his hand and tries to kiss it and is so grateful to be liberated. And Jake just simply doesn't know what to do. There's beyond the awkwardness of being misthanked. This was not the person that the credit should have gone to. He's simply so appalled. He's been walking around for a day and literally writing down statistics until it doesn't mean anything anymore. You know, when you say so many thousands a day were dying, what is that? One is too many. How do you calculate all of that? So he's stunned. I don't think this reaction, by the way, was at all unusual. And one of the reasons that I wanted to put it in the book was that I think it's crucial to an understanding of that period. I think anyone who participated in the opening of the camps, and even if you did not personally do so in the first newsreels of them, were as stunned. We're 50 years later, and it's still as stunning to us. We simply can't comprehend the horror that this represents. Well, imagine if you were there on the spot. Murrow, for instance, was indeed in one of the liberation and never got over it. Eisenhower never got over it. If people at the highest macro level, think what happens to the ordinary GI who just stumbles into it with no knowledge whatsoever of what he's about to see. It was truly horrifying. And it was the great crime that overhang everything. I mean, I said at one point in the book that the difficulty in trying to bring people to some form of justice about this was extraordinarily complex. There was a Goebbels line, you know, his famous quote is that if you make the lie big enough, everybody will believe it. And in some horrible way, what was beginning to happen here was that if you made the crime big enough, nobody did it. There wasn't a way to really assign guilt in that way. But it hangs over everything. And I think Berlin not only was a war site, but it operated maybe metaphorically, but metaphors are what we deal with in books. But it operated as a vast scene of the crime, that something had happened here that was just never going to go away. And you feel, even now when you're in Germany, this is the monkey on the back that doesn't leave. It's, I think to the credit of that society, it's prompted endless self-questioning and endless self-recrimination and questions about what we did and who was responsible and, you know, questions that aren't going to stop.
Well, as evil as Goebbels was, he was not stupid. And the big lie, that seems to come true more often than we like to admit, but we won't even go there.
Hélas, hélas.
My guest is Joseph Cannon. Having enjoyed your other two books tremendously, I was so impressed by The Good German because I could see your development as a writer in these books, and I love the first two books, but I see this book as a continuing growth, as a culmination of all your craft coming together. I mentioned that little snapshot of the prisoner coming up and shaking hands. You have these little snapshots like that. Jake is walking down the street, and it's dark, and out of the rubble, a prostitute shines a flashlight on her face and says something to him. Stuff like that. This is so fleshed out. You have these great characters. I love the woman who's the photographer. I love the Soviet general. These are very real.
Thank you. That's exactly the effect one hopes for. You know, people will often ask me, how do you do the research for these books? And this one in particular, because I felt that the material was so important. You don't want to trivialize material like this. It's really significant stuff. And of course, we can talk about it, going to Berlin, doing lots of reading, etc. But at a certain point, you leave that behind and you simply live it in your head. And You know, I never read anything that had a prostitute on a street lighting up her face. I knew that they carried flashlights because there were no lights. And it occurred to me that this would be almost a looming, eerie effect if you were walking down a dark street just to see these faces lit from underneath. But I don't know where that comes from. Ultimately, it does become an imaginative world. For about 2 years plus, I guess, I got up every day and went to work and went to live in Berlin in my head. And it was often a pretty depressing place to be. I mean, for me, it was exciting because I thought it was also fascinating, and that the variety of response to what went on there was a mosaic that I had not encountered elsewhere. You know, I would look at various things that I had read about and wanted to put them all together. One thing always leads to another. For instance, there's a character in the book who had been a U-boat. These were the Jews that actually survived in Berlin during the war. I had not known that there were any. It turns out that something like 4,000 to 5,000 Jews survived the war in Berlin, in some part because it's a big city and you could get lost in it. If you were in a village, somebody was likely to turn you in.
This wasn't Renata.
No. Well, Renata begins as a U-boat.
Okay.
But Gunther's wife was a U-boat.
Right, okay.
And
he's another good character, Gunther.
The German cop. Uh-huh. And maybe the good German cop.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the other things that I want to do with the title is that I want people, as they read the book, to think, is this the good German? Is this, and what does it mean? You know, how do we make that?
You can't cheat and go to the last page either. The book is The Good German by Joseph Cannon. You're listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO, revisiting an interview I recorded 20 years ago with the novelist Joseph Cannon. And we'll continue with our final segment right after this. You're listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. And as we go through this COVID situation, a lot of people have been turning to podcasts to while away those hours in isolation. And if you like listening to authors talk about their books, why don't you check out all the podcasts we have archived at wyso.org and our Book Nook pages, over 700 interviews you can listen to whenever you want. Let's continue now with the final segment of my 2001 interview with Joseph Cannon. Joe, as I was reading the book, I was really enthralled by the power games that were going on and the tremendous sense of power. And I was reading your press material, and I think you had a quote in there from some American officer who made the statement, "Okay, I want to make a law."
Yes. I don't know whether it's apocryphal, but it certainly has passed into the lore that General Clay, who was the head of our government there, at one point turned to his secretary, who had her steno pad out, and said, "Take a law." And it seemed to be indicative of the kind of power that we had. If you wanted to requisition somebody's house, they had to be out in half an hour. If you wanted to say nobody on the streets after 8 o'clock, that was it. You know, there weren't channels to go through. Most people don't realize, I mean, Germany did not achieve full sovereignty until 1950. We were there for many years, and then, of course, had a substantial military presence afterwards. But for several years, we were the government. We were the law. Yes, there were local Germans who were put in place to actually do a lot of the work. You know, I'm not suggesting that all the sewers were repaired by Americans, but America was the top sovereignty. And we were the people that helped, draft the new Constitution and make the new justice system. I mean, when, you know, now we talk about nation building, in our current situation, this was truly a case of nation building. And in some part, because there is an idealistic strain, I think, in American life, and it's one that I applaud, that's not a criticism, I think we wanted to make a better country there. I mean, you know, nobody wanted the return of Nazism in any form whatsoever, including by that time most of the Germans themselves. And I think it was our intention not just to create a bulwark against the Soviets. That's the cynical point of view, and it's true to a certain extent. But there was also the generous-minded side of this, that we had a chance here to help this country create itself as a democratic power. And I think we largely succeeded in that. You know, we often beat ourselves up for things that we've done in the past 50 years, and rightly so. I think every country is a mixed bag, and we have a lot to answer for in various areas. But the record here is an interesting and often very positive one. I think a lot of good was done during this period. Certainly a lot of good intentions were flying around. And if we didn't fully succeed in administering some form of justice to this horrible crime, I don't know that it would have been possible for anyone. It so happens that we were sandbagged, or at least compromised in many ways, by our own agendas. We were talking before about the scientists. If somebody was useful to us, it might actually happen that you could give him a pass, no matter what he had done. I don't applaud that. I think that's one of those stains on our blotter that is not going to go away. But nevertheless, there were other reasons that the thing was maybe not going to work as fully as it should have. American corporations who had counterparts in Germany who didn't want to see us enter a quagmire of putting a whole country on trial, including their peers or their working colleagues. Well, all right, one can understand that point of view. There was also, an anti-Semitism at home. It was that summer that a congressman stands up, it's in the congressional record, and objects to the denazification program because he says that he objects to seeing American taxpayer dollars go to support a minority group seeking revenge. And this is said in Congress just a few months after Auschwitz is discovered.
You know, was he from Wisconsin? Just kidding.
No, and I'm not going to tell you where. In fact, I decided to conveniently forget in case anybody asked.
My guess is Joseph Cannon. I went to Berlin in 1973, the divided Berlin. Went to actually East Berlin too. And the thing I remember about West Berlin was a sense of claustrophobia, a sense of desperation. This is a very strange place. There are a lot of ghosts in this place. And the thing that really struck me was all the churches sitting there, bombed out exactly like they were during the war. They hadn't done anything to them except spray paint graffiti all over them.
Yeah, it is still to this day. It's no longer claustrophobic, obviously, because it's all open. And in fact, now it's a very young, exciting city and an increasingly rich one because it's become the capital. And I think we've all read about the building programs. It is literally true that you can get on the S-Bahn and see a sea of cranes. I mean, thousands of building cranes. It's like something out of ancient Egypt. You think, how can you create a capital overnight? But they're doing it. Nevertheless, it's still one of those cities where you can turn a corner and the past comes rushing up at you. I think it gives a certain quality to the city that makes it fascinating and interesting. Certainly for me and anyone who has taken an interest in the period. There are also kind of ironies in the tourist circuit there. For all the right reasons, I'll give you an example. For all the right reasons, it was decided to bulldoze over Hitler's bunker so it could never become a shrine. It should never be a place of pilgrimage, either for tourists or lunatics who actually were going to pay homage, and it must just disappear. The other side to that coin, of course, is that people really wanted to forget and even have no visual reminders of the period. So what happened is that it was bulldozed over, and a housing project was put up in the whole area, including a children's playground. The irony is that people still try to see it. And even though there's nothing to see, you will pass the neighboring street and look at people who are obviously not living in the housing project. They're American tourists or British tourists or whoever, who are walking around trying to figure out exactly where the bunker entrance is. You know, this is one of those things, it just goes with the flow in Berlin. You can turn a street corner. There's a place down in Schönberg where there's just this concrete structure. And what it is one of the flak towers, the only one that survived the war where they had the anti-aircraft, because it was so strongly built that it withstood all the bombings, and they tried to dynamite it, and it still withstood that. And so it serves as a reminder of the Berlin that's gone. You know, when I was researching the book, one of the Berlin 1945 has vanished because it was all bombed out. There are, in the East, where you saw the depressing part, because of the benign neglect of the communists and the lack of money, frankly, a lot of stuff was left to rubble quite late. That has turned out to be a tourist bonanza because it meant that it wasn't bulldozed over and the buildings could be restored, so that there were parts of East Berlin, particularly, where you can see what it must once have looked like, or at least some of it. But for me, interestingly, it wasn't a problem because, by definition, all of the occupation building, all the American military buildings had survived the bombing. This is what we used. And they survive still. I mean, anyone who is interested in this period can go and see the Kommandantura and where the Allied Control Council met and General Clay's headquarters. And all of this was, to a historical novelist or a novelist of the recent past, sort of catnip. I love seeing where things actually happen. You want to see what the doorways look like and where the, you know, where the steps marble. You may not ever use it, and it may not actually come out in the book, but I think it's useful to know so that you can see what the characters see. Anyway, a lot of that stuff is still around.
Combining history, suspense, love. It's a thriller, and he keeps you very involved and wondering who the bad guys are, who is who, where did they go, where are we going to find them, how are we going to solve these mysteries, and kept me up late last night.
I'm always glad to hear that.
Now, I'm intrigued by publishing, and I know that you're a veteran of the industry from a lot of different aspects, and I love reading the New York Times Book Review, and I love reading reviews in the New York Times. I'm always intrigued. I'm amazed when they pan a book that I like, and I'm amazed by the dirt they have in there. Yesterday there was I think it was Ben Cheever's book that they were reviewing, and they mentioned the fact that he'd gone to Antioch College, which rang bells with me, and then they mentioned the fact that he'd been married to Janet Maslin, and I thought to myself, what a brutal existence that must have been for a writer to be married to this woman who can be such a vicious critic of books. I'm intrigued by this kind of stuff.
Well, he's still married to her.
Is he really?
And I think, actually, the reputation that she has is she may not have liked a book that you liked, but her reputation is that, in general, she's a generous-minded reviewer. So I don't know her personally, so this is not coming from any kind of friendship side. And Ben being her husband, I mean, I think the way publishing is so incestuous is that to be reviewed in the Times, you know, they can only do X number of books per year. And it is the paper of record for New York, and so it's an important review outlet. To be married to one of its three permanent reviewers puts you in the dubious position of having to do it on your own, you know, or be accused of influence peddling, which I'm sure was not the case. She wouldn't do that.
Well, the review was not by a Times reviewer. They're very careful.
An outsider,
right. I had Maria Arana on the program with her book American Chica, and I see where she's been put up for the National Book Award, I think she was nominated for. And when I found out about her background and her history and what she does for a living and who she's married to, it's just so intriguing.
Well, these things happen. People have to be married to somebody, you know.
And you're hanging around with people in the industry, and by golly, it's like movie stars getting married, I think.
It's true. It's, you know, it's a lot less incestuous than people would like to think. As a country, we're great believers in conspiracy theories. I'm a great believer in usually incompetence. I mean, I think when things go wrong, it's because somebody has just made a mistake, not because they've been put up to it. Maybe.
Well, I know we digress, but it's really been a good thing to have you come back on the program, and I'm really glad I didn't miss the opportunity.
Oh, my pleasure, always.
My guest has been Joseph Cannon. The book is The Good German. That was Joseph Cannon, recorded 20 years ago, talking about his novel, The Good German. And he came back for one more interview a couple years after that, and I remember that last interview, that fourth one, distinctly because there was a young man from the Wright State Film Department who was shadowing me that day. This is back when I was the music director at WYSO. He followed me around. He followed me to the mailroom. He followed me through the halls of Antioch MacGregor. And he actually filmed my entire interview with Joseph Cannon. And that was really interesting. He turned it into a short film. And it's really a slice of time. I've got it on a VHS tape somewhere. And I try not to watch it because it's just too bizarre to see someone filming me interviewing someone and not even really paying attention to it. I'd like to note that my favorite underground cartoonist has died. His name was S. Clay Wilson. I just saw his obit in the New York Times. Headline, S. Clay Wilson, 79, creator of underground cartoons, gleefully crossing the line. When I was in school, we used to hit the record stores. There were four of them down by Drake University. And a favorite one was called Elysian Fields. You go down to their basement, and it was illuminated by black lights alone. It was a shoplifter's paradise. I was not one of those, but they had all these black light posters on the walls. And you walk through Pebbles, and there was incense burning and lots of great jazz albums and underground comics, stacks of them that you could buy. And that's how I discovered S. Clay Wilson. I'm going to bring you some little tidbits from his obit. S. Clay Wilson, the most scabrous and rollicking of the underground cartoonists who first achieved notoriety as contributors to Zap Comics in the late 1960s, died on Sunday at his home in San Francisco. He was 79. His wife, Lorraine Chamberlain, said the cause was deteriorating health arising from a traumatic brain injury more than 12 years ago. He had experienced a number of serious health problems in recent years. Violent, obscene, and scatological, Mr. Wilson's hyperbolic stories, full of corny puns and incongruously decorous dialogue, and populated by such unsavory, anatomically distorted characters as the checkered demon and the hog-riding fools. They're indescribable in this newspaper. Interviewed in the early 1990s for the Comics Journal by the underground comics aficionado Bob Levin, Mr. Wilson called comics, quote, a great visual art form, adding, primarily, I'm trying to show you that you can draw anything you want. His drawings were so outrageous in their humorous depravity that on first encountering them in 1968, his fellow cartoonist R. Crumb recalled feeling that, quote, suddenly my work seemed insipid. Stephen Clay Wilson was born in Lincoln, Nebraska on July 25, 1941, the first child of John William Wilson, a master machinist, and Ione Lydia Lewis Wilson, a medical stenographer. Inspired by EC horror comics like Tales from the Crypt, he began drawing as a child. After leaving the University of Nebraska, he served in the Army, then joined a circle of Beat Generation artists and poets in Lawrence, Kansas. His first published work in a Lawrence underground newspaper, The Screw, and a small literary magazine, Grist, showed his style fully developed. In 1968, Mr. Wilson relocated to San Francisco, where he quickly became one of the leading underground cartoonists, as well as something of a counterculture celebrity, partying with Janis Joplin and other local rock musicians. He contributed to Zap Comics No. 2, a 14-page comic strip concerning the misadventures of a befuddled biker gang. Mr. Wilson also contributed to Arcade, the ambitious, if short-lived, comic book quarterly edited in the mid-70s by Bill Griffith and Art Spiegelman. The fourth issue featured a story by William S. Burroughs that was illustrated by Mr. Wilson and that led to a long association with William Burroughs. He was amazing. This stuff isn't for everybody, but as a teenager, I loved it. It was so rebellious. S. Clay Wilson, my favorite underground cartoonist. May he rest in peace. You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. My name is Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in, and thanks for supporting your public radio station. We can count on you. Have a great weekend.